While the Germans were working on rockets and jets, the American Manhattan Project successfully developed atomic bombs. By the time the bomb was ready, in early August 1945, Germany had already surrendered, but Japan was fighting on. American forces were poised to invade its home islands. The Japanese vowed to resist the invasion and fight to the death, and there was every reason to believe that it was no idle threat. American generals told President Harry S. Truman that an invasion of Japan would cost the lives of 1 million American soldiers and would extend the war well into 1946. Truman decided to use the new bomb. 2 weeks and two atom bombs later, Japan surrendered unconditionally, and the war was over. But science is not just about offensive weapons. It plays a major role in our defenses as well. Today, many Americans believe that the solution to terrorism is technological rather than political. Just give millions more to the nanotechnology industry, they believe, and the United States could send bionic spy flies into every Afghan cave, Yemenite redoubt, and North African encampment. Once that's done, Osama bin Laden's heirs will not be able to make a cup of coffee without a CIA spy fly passing this vital information back to headquarters in Langley. Allocate millions more to brain research, and every airport could be equipped with ultra-sophisticated fMRI scanners that could immediately recognize angry and hateful thoughts in people's brains. Will it really work? Who knows? Is it wise to develop bionic flies and thought-reading scanners? Not necessarily. Be that as it may, as you hear these lines, the U.S. Department of Defense is transferring millions of dollars to nanotechnology and brain laboratories for work on these and other such ideas. This obsession with military technology, from tanks to atom bombs to spy flies, is a surprisingly recent phenomenon. Up until the 19th century, the vast majority of military revolutions were the product of organizational rather than technological changes. When alien civilizations met for the first time, technological gaps sometimes played an important role. But even in such cases, few thought of deliberately creating or enlarging such gaps. Most empires did not rise thanks to technological wizardry, and their rulers did not give much thought to technological improvement. The Arabs did not defeat the Sassanid Empire thanks to superior bows or swords. The Seljuks had no technological advantage over the Byzantines, and the Mongols did not conquer China with the help of some ingenious new weapon. In fact, in all these cases, the vanquished enjoyed superior military and civilian technology. The Roman army is a particularly good example. It was the best army of its day, yet, technologically speaking, Rome had no edge over Carthage, Macedonia, or the Seleucid Empire. Its advantage rested on efficient organization, iron discipline, and huge manpower reserves. The Roman army never set up a research and development department, and its weapons remained more or less the same for centuries on end. If the legions of Scipio Aemilianus, the general who leveled Carthage and defeated the Numantians in the 2nd century BC, had suddenly popped up 500 years later in the age of Constantine the Great, Scipio would have had a fair chance of beating Constantine. Now imagine what would happen to a general from a few centuries back, say Napoleon, if he led his troops against a modern armored brigade. Napoleon was a brilliant tactician, and his men were crack professionals, but their skills would be useless in the face of modern weaponry. As in Rome, so also in ancient China, most generals and philosophers did not think it their duty to develop new weapons. The most important military invention in the history of China was gunpowder. Yet, to the best of our knowledge, gunpowder was invented accidentally by Taoist alchemists searching for the elixir of life. Gunpowder's subsequent career is even more telling. One might have thought that the Taoist alchemists would have made China master of the world. In fact, the Chinese used the new compound mainly for firecrackers. Even as the Song Empire collapsed in the face of a Mongol invasion, no emperor set up a medieval Manhattan Project to save the empire by inventing a doomsday weapon. Only in the 15th century, about 600 years after the invention of gunpowder, did did cannons become a decisive factor on Afro-Asian battlefields? Why did it take so long for the deadly potential of this substance to be put to military use? Because it appeared at a time when neither kings, scholars, nor merchants thought that new military technology could save them or make them rich. The situation began to change in the 15th and 16th centuries, but another 200 years went by before most rulers evinced any interest in financing the research and development of new weapons. Logistics and strategy continue to have far greater impact on the outcome of wars than technology. The Napoleonic military machine that crushed the armies of the European powers at Austerlitz, 1805, was armed with more or less the same weaponry that the army of Louis XVI had used. Napoleon himself, despite being an artilleryman, had little interest in new weapons, even though scientists and inventors tried to persuade him to fund the development of flying machines, submarines, and rockets. Science, industry, and military technology intertwined only with the advent of the capitalist system and the Industrial Revolution. Once this relationship was established, however, it quickly transformed the world. The ideal of progress. Until the Scientific Revolution, most human cultures did not believe in progress. They thought the Golden Age was in the past and that the world was stagnant, if not deteriorating. Strict adherence to the wisdom of the ages might perhaps bring back the good old times, and human ingenuity might conceivably improve this or that facet of daily life. However, it was considered impossible for human know-how to overcome the world's fundamental problems. If even Muhammad, Jesus, Buddha, and Confucius, who knew everything there is to know, were unable to abolish famine, disease, poverty, and war from the world, how could we expect to do so? Many faiths believed that someday a Messiah would appear and end all wars, famines, and even death itself. But the notion that humankind could do so by discovering new knowledge and inventing new tools was worse than ludicrous. It was hubris. The story of the Tower of Babel, the story of Icarus, the story of the Golem, and countless other myths taught people that any attempt to go beyond human limitations would inevitably lead to disappointment and disaster. When modern culture admitted that there were many important things that it still did not know, and when that admission of ignorance was married to the idea that scientific discoveries could give us new powers, people began suspecting that real progress might be possible after all. As science began to solve one unsolvable problem after another, many became convinced that humankind could overcome any and every problem by acquiring and applying new knowledge. Poverty, sickness, wars, famines, old age, and death itself were not the inevitable fate of humankind. They were simply the fruits of our ignorance. A famous example is lightning. Many cultures believed that lightning was the hammer of an angry god used to punish sinners. In the middle of the 18th century, in one of the most celebrated experiments in scientific history, Benjamin Franklin flew a kite during a lightning storm to test the hypothesis that lightning is simply an electric current. Franklin's empirical observations, coupled with his knowledge about the qualities of electrical energy, enabled him to invent the lightning rod and disarm the gods. Poverty is another case in point. Many cultures have viewed poverty as an inescapable part of this imperfect world. According to the New Testament, shortly before the crucifixion, a woman anointed Christ with precious oil worth 300 denarii. Jesus' disciples scolded the woman for wasting such a huge sum of money instead of giving it to the poor. But Jesus defended her, saying that the poor you will always have with you, and you can help them any time you want, but you will not always have me. Mark 14:7. Today, fewer and fewer people, including fewer and fewer Christians, agree with Jesus on this matter. Poverty is increasingly seen as a technical problem, amenable to intervention. It's common wisdom that policies based on the latest findings in agronomy, economics, medicine, and sociology can eliminate poverty. And indeed, many parts of the world have already been freed from the worst forms of deprivation. Throughout history, societies have suffered from two kinds of poverty. Social poverty, which withholds from some people the opportunities available to others, and biological poverty, which puts the very lives of individuals at risk due to lack of food and shelter. Perhaps social poverty can never be eradicated, but in many countries around the world, biological poverty is a thing of the past. Until recently, most people hovered very close to the biological poverty line, below which a person lacks enough calories to sustain life for long. Even small miscalculations or misfortunes could easily push people below that line into starvation. Natural disasters and man-made calamities often plunged entire populations over the abyss, causing the death of millions. Today, most of the world's people have a safety net stretched below them. Individuals are protected from personal misfortune by insurance, state-sponsored social security, and a plethora of local and international NGOs. When calamity strikes an entire region, worldwide relief efforts are usually successful in preventing the worst. People still suffer from numerous degradations, humiliations, and poverty-related illnesses, but in most countries, nobody is starving to death. In fact, in many societies, more people are in danger of dying from obesity than from starvation. The Gilgamesh Project. Of all mankind's ostensibly insoluble problems, one has remained the most vexing, interesting, and important: the problem of death itself. Before the late modern era, most religions and ideologies took it for granted that death was our inevitable fate. Moreover, most faiths turned death into the main source of meaning in life. Try to imagine Islam, Christianity, or the ancient Egyptian religion in a world without death. These creeds taught people that they must come to terms with death and pin their hopes on the afterlife rather than seek to overcome death and live forever here on earth. The best minds were busy giving meaning to death, not trying to escape it. That is the theme of the most ancient myth to come down to us, the Gilgamesh myth of ancient Sumer. Its hero is the strongest and most capable man in the world, King Gilgamesh of Uruk, who could defeat anyone in battle. One day, Gilgamesh's best friend, Enkidu, died. Gilgamesh sat by the body and observed it for many days, until he saw a worm dropping out of his friend's nostril. At that moment, Gilgamesh was gripped by a terrible horror, and he resolved that he himself would never die. He would somehow find a way to defeat death. Gilgamesh then undertook a journey to the end of the universe, killing lions, battling scorpion men, and finding his way into the underworld. There he shattered the mysterious stone things of Ur-Shanabi, the ferryman of the River of the Dead, and found Utnapishtim, the last survivor of the primordial flood. Yet Gilgamesh failed in his quest. He returned home empty-handed, as mortal as ever, but with one new piece of wisdom. When the gods created man, Gilgamesh had learned, they set death as man's inevitable destiny, and man must learn to live with it. Disciples of progress do not share this defeatist attitude. For men of science, death is not an inevitable destiny, but merely a technical problem. People die not because the gods decreed it, but due to various technical failures, a heart attack, cancer, an infection. And every technical problem has a technical solution. If the heart flutters, it can be stimulated by a pacemaker or replaced by a new heart. If cancer rampages, it can be killed with drugs or radiation. If bacteria proliferate, they can be subdued with antibiotics. True, at present we cannot solve all technical problems, but we are working on them. Our best minds are not wasting their time trying to give meaning to death. Instead, they are busy investigating the physiological, hormonal, and genetic systems responsible for disease and old age. They are developing new medicines, revolutionary treatments, and artificial organs that will lengthen our lives and might one day vanquish the Grim Reaper himself. Until recently, you would not have heard scientists or anyone else speak so bluntly. Defeat death? What nonsense! We are only trying to cure cancer, tuberculosis, and Alzheimer's disease, they insisted. People avoided the issue of death because the goal seemed too elusive. Why create unreasonable expectations? We're now at a point, however, where we can be frank about it. The leading project of the scientific revolution is to give humankind eternal life. Even if killing death seems a distant goal, we have already achieved things that were inconceivable a few centuries ago. In 1199, King Richard the Lionheart was struck by an arrow in his left shoulder. Today, we'd say he incurred a minor injury. But in 1199, in the absence of antibiotics and effective sterilization methods, this minor flesh wound turned infected and gangrene set in. The only way to stop the spread of gangrene in 12th century Europe was to cut off the infected limb, impossible when the infection was in a shoulder. The gangrene spread through the Lionheart's body, and no one could help the king. He died in great agony 2 weeks later. As recently as the 19th century, the best doctors still did not know how to prevent infection and stop the putrefaction of tissues. In field hospitals, doctors routinely cut off the hands and legs of soldiers who received even minor limb injuries, fearing gangrene. These amputations, as well as all other medical procedures, such as tooth extraction, were done without any anesthetics. The first anesthetics, ether, chloroform, and morphine, entered regular usage in Western medicine only in the middle of the 19th century. Before the advent of chloroform, four soldiers had to hold down a wounded comrade while the doctor sawed off the injured limb. On the morning after the Battle of Waterloo, 1815, heaps of sawn-off hands and legs could be seen adjacent to the field hospitals. In those days, carpenters and butchers who enlisted to the army were often sent to serve in the medical corps, because surgery required little more than knowing your way with knives and saws. In the 2 centuries since Waterloo, things have changed beyond recognition. Pills, injections, and sophisticated operations save us from a spate of illnesses and injuries that once dealt an inescapable death sentence. They also protect us against countless daily aches and ailments, which pre-modern people simply accepted as part of life. The average life expectancy jumped from around 25 to 40 years, to around 67 in the entire world, and to around 80 years in the developed world. Death suffered its worst setbacks in the arena of child mortality. Until the 20th century, between a quarter and a third of the children of agricultural societies never reached adulthood. Most succumbed to childhood diseases such as diphtheria, measles, and smallpox. In 17th century England, 150 out of every 1,000 newborns died during their first year, and a third of all children were dead before they reached 15. Today, only 5 out of 1,000 English babies die during their first year, and only 7 out of 1,000 die before age 15. We can better grasp the full impact of these figures by setting aside statistics and telling some stories. A good example is the family of King Edward I of England, 1237 to 1307, and his wife, Queen Eleanor, 1241 to 1290. Their children enjoyed the best conditions and the most nurturing surroundings that could be provided in medieval Europe. They lived in palaces, ate as much food as they liked, had plenty of warm clothing, well-stocked fireplaces, the cleanest water available, an army of servants, and the best doctors. The sources mention 16 children that Queen Eleanor bore between 1255 and 1284. 1. An anonymous daughter born in 1255 died at birth. 2. A daughter, Catherine, died either at age 1 or age 3. 3. A daughter, Joan, died at 6 months. 4. A son, John, died at age 5. 5. A son, Henry, died at age 6. 6. A daughter, Eleanor, died at age 29. 7. An anonymous daughter died at 5 months. 8. A daughter, Joan, died at age 35. 9. A son, Alfonso, died at age 10. 10. A daughter, Margaret, died at age 58. 11. A daughter, Berengaria, died at age 2. 12. An anonymous daughter died shortly after birth. 13. A daughter, Mary, died at age 53. 14. An anonymous son died shortly after birth. 15. A daughter, Elizabeth, died at age 34. 16. A son, Edward. The youngest, Edward, was the first of the boys to survive the dangerous years of childhood, and at his father's death, he ascended the English throne as King Edward II. In other words, it took Eleanor 16 tries to carry out the most fundamental mission of an English queen, to provide her husband with a male heir. Edward II's mother must have been a woman of exceptional patience and fortitude. Not so the woman Edward chose for his wife, Isabella of France. She had him murdered when he was 43. To the best of our knowledge, Eleanor and Edward I were a healthy couple and passed no fatal hereditary illnesses on to their children. Nevertheless, 10 out of the 16, 62%, died during childhood. Only 6 managed to live beyond the age of 11, and only 3, just 18%, lived beyond the age of 40. In addition to these births, Eleanor most likely had a number of pregnancies that ended in miscarriage. On average, Edward and Eleanor lost a child every 3 years, 10 children, one after another. It's nearly impossible for a parent today to imagine such loss. How long will the Gilgamesh Project, the quest for immortality, take to complete? 100 years? 500 years? 1,000 years? When we recall how little we knew about the human body in 1900, and how much knowledge we have gained in a single century, there is cause for optimism. Genetic engineers have recently managed to double the average life expectancy of Caenorhabditis elegans worms. Could they do the same for Homo sapiens? Nanotechnology experts are developing a bionic immune system composed of millions of nanorobots who would inhabit our bodies, open blocked blood vessels, fight viruses and bacteria, eliminate cancerous cells, and even reverse aging processes. A few serious scholars suggest that by 2050, some humans will become amortal. Not immortal, because they could still die of some accident, but amortal, meaning that in the absence of fatal trauma, their lives could be extended indefinitely. Whether or not Project Gilgamesh succeeds, from a historical perspective, it is fascinating to see that most late modern religions and ideologies have already taken death and the afterlife out of the equation. Until the 18th century, religions considered death and its aftermath central to the meaning of life. Beginning in the 18th century, religions and ideologies such as liberalism, socialism, and feminism lost all interest in the afterlife. What exactly happens to a communist after he or she dies? What happens to a capitalist? What happens to a feminist? It is pointless to look for the answer in the writings of Marx, Adam Smith, or Simone de Beauvoir. The only modern ideology that still awards death a central role is nationalism. In its more poetic and desperate moments, nationalism promises that whoever dies for the nation will forever live in its collective memory. Yet this promise is so fuzzy that even most nationalists do not really know what to make of it. The sugar daddy of science. We are living in a technical age. Many are convinced that science and technology hold the answers to all our problems. We should just let the scientists and technicians go on with their work, and they will create heaven here on earth. But science is not an enterprise that takes place on some superior moral or spiritual plane above the rest of human activity. Like all other parts of our culture, it is shaped by economic, political, and religious interests. Science is a very expensive affair. A biologist seeking to understand the human immune system requires laboratories, test tubes, chemicals, and electron microscopes, not to mention lab assistants, electricians, plumbers, and cleaners. An economist seeking to model credit markets must buy computers, set up giant databanks, and develop complicated data processing programs. An archaeologist who wishes to understand the behavior of archaic hunter-gatherers must travel to distant lands, excavate ancient ruins, and date fossilized bones and artifacts. All of this costs money. During the past 500 years, modern science has achieved wonders, thanks largely to the willingness of governments, businesses, foundations, and private donors to channel billions of dollars into scientific research. These billions have done much more to chart the universe, map the planet, and catalogue the animal kingdom than did Galileo, Galilei, Christopher Columbus, and Charles Darwin. If these particular geniuses had never been born, their insights would probably have occurred to others. But if the proper funding were unavailable, no intellectual brilliance could have compensated for that. If Darwin had never been born, for example, we'd today attribute the theory of evolution to Alfred Russel Wallace, who came up with the idea of evolution via natural selection independently of Darwin and just a few years later. But if the European powers had not financed geographical, zoological, and botanical research around the world, neither Darwin nor Wallace would have had the necessary empirical data to develop the theory of evolution. It is likely that they would not even have tried. Why did the billions start flowing from government and business coffers into labs and universities? In academic circles, many are naive enough to believe in pure science. They believe that government and business altruistically give them money to pursue whatever research projects strike their fancy. But this hardly describes the realities of science funding. Most scientific studies are funded because somebody believes they can help attain some political, economic, or religious goal. For example, in the 16th century, kings and bankers channeled enormous resources to finance geographical expeditions around the world, but not a penny for studying child psychology. This is because kings and bankers surmised that the discovery of new geographical knowledge would enable them to conquer new lands and set up trade empires, whereas they couldn't see any profit in understanding child psychology. In the 1940s, the governments of America and the Soviet Union channeled enormous resources to the study of nuclear physics rather than underwater archaeology. They surmised that studying nuclear physics would enable them to develop nuclear weapons, whereas underwater archaeology was unlikely to help win wars. Scientists themselves are not always aware of the political, economic, and religious interests that control the flow of money. Many scientists do, in fact, act out of pure intellectual curiosity. However, only rarely do scientists dictate the scientific agenda. Even if we wanted to finance pure science unaffected by political, economic, or religious interests, it would probably be impossible. Our resources are limited, after all. Ask a congressman to allocate an additional $1 million to the National Science Foundation for basic research, and he'll justifiably ask whether that money wouldn't be better used to fund teacher training or to give a needed tax break to a troubled factory in his district. To channel limited resources, we must answer questions such as, what is more important? And what is good? And these are not scientific questions. Science can explain what exists in the world, how things work, and what might be in the future. By definition, it has no pretensions to knowing what should be in the future. Only religions and ideologies seek to answer such questions. Consider the following quandary. Two biologists from the same department, possessing the same professional skills, have both applied for a $1 million grant to finance their current research projects. Professor Slughorn wants to study a disease that infects the udders of cows, causing a 10% decrease in their milk production. Professor Sprout wants to study whether cows suffer mentally when they are separated from their calves. Assuming that the amount of money is limited and that it is impossible to finance both research projects, which one should be funded? There is no scientific answer to this question. There are only political, economic, and religious answers. In today's world, it is obvious that Slughorn has a better chance of getting the money. Not because udder diseases are scientifically more interesting than bovine mentality, but because the dairy industry, which stands to benefit from the research, has more political and economic clout than the animal rights lobby. Perhaps in a strict Hindu society where cows are sacred, or in a society committed to animal rights, Professor Sprout would have a better shot. But as long as she lives in a society that values the commercial potential of milk and the health of its human citizens over the feelings of cows, she'd best write up her research proposal so as to appeal to those assumptions. For example, she might write that depression leads to a decrease in milk production. If we understand the mental world of dairy cows, we could develop psychiatric medication that will improve their mood, thus raising milk production by up to 10%. I estimate that there is a global annual market of $250 million for bovine psychiatric medications. Science is unable to set its own priorities. It is also incapable of determining what to do with its discoveries. For example, from a purely scientific viewpoint, it is unclear what we should do with our increasing understanding of genetics. Should we use this knowledge to cure cancer, to create a race of genetically engineered supermen, or to engineer dairy cows with supersized udders? It is obvious that a liberal government, a communist government, a Nazi government, and a capitalist business corporation would use the very same scientific discovery for completely different purposes, and there is no scientific reason to prefer one usage over others. In short, scientific research can flourish only in alliance with some religion or ideology. The ideology justifies the costs of the research. In exchange, the ideology influences the scientific agenda and determines what to do with the discoveries. Hence, in order to comprehend how humankind has reached Alamogordo and the moon, rather than any number of alternative destinations, it is not enough to survey the achievements of physicists, biologists, and sociologists. We have to take into account the ideological, political, and economic forces that shaped physics, biology, and sociology, pushing them in certain directions while neglecting others. Two forces in particular deserve our attention: imperialism and capitalism. The feedback loop between science, empire, and capital has arguably been history's chief engine for the past 500 years. The following chapters analyze its workings. First, we'll look at how the twin turbines of science and empire would latch to one another, and then learn how both were hitched up to the money pump of capitalism.